The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 20th, 2016. It's the dog days of summer. The depths of August. It's gross out. We're dripping with sweat, as are you, I'm sure. But we are not going dark. Paul Manafort may be gone from the Trump campaign, but we are here on the Lawfare podcast. 2 years ago at this time, we brought you the special Zombie Apocalypse edition. Last year, we just took a break for a week. But this year, we are taking your questions. You have been tweeting all week to hashtag LawfareAMA, and we have been storing up your questions. Managing editor Susan Hennessy and I are here today. We're going to get through as many of them as we can. We have questions on Trump, on election hacks, on the intelligence agency hacks, not to mention evergreen subjects like the War Powers Resolution and other legislative questions about national security and law. We've got Quinta Jurassic here to channel your souls and read the questions. We will be getting through as many of them as we can over the next 45 to 60 minutes. It's the Lawfare Podcast episode, I'm not even sure, hashtag Lawfare AMA.
All right, so our first question comes from at Trojan7Sec, who asks whether it is illegal to put a bid into the alleged NSA leaks.
So this is a good question. Short answer, yes. It is illegal to attempt to receive or purchase stolen property. So bidding on it is probably not a good idea. That said, actually, it is a really interesting question. Under the Espionage Act, it is illegal to attempt to purchase or receive classified information or information related to, I think, defense installations. There's a long list. You know, it's funny, of course, the NSA and the government has not confirmed this is authentic information. And so it's just speculative, right? It's one person's claim that this is defense information. So I would not worry about being prosecuted under any of those statutes, but I would not put in a bid if I were you.
So the other thing there is that the person who bid on it would be similarly situated in most legal respects to a newspaper receiving a leak, right? You're not, I mean, it's optically different, but from an Espionage Act point of view and from a receipt of stolen property point of view, they're not really differently situated than The Guardian or The New York Times is with respect to the Snowden revelations.
So I'm not sure that's true, because under the Pentagon Papers case, right, they say that essentially once information has been leaked, there's no, the government isn't allowed to then control its publication, right? It's only the sort of initial leak, and newspapers are allowed to then publish it without being prosecuted. But in this case, you're actually buying the leak itself, right?
Yeah, but,
you're buying the decryption.
But hang on. I'll leave aside the publication of the material. If you bid on this, you are offering money in order to receive stolen information. And you're violating on its face, whether it's constitutional or not, the secondary transmission components of the Espionage Act. Why is that different if you're the New York Times and you're not offering to pay?
Because you are not, I think in this case, the fact that what you're actually purchasing is the decryption and then publication of, right? So it's actually the criminal act, the leak itself. I don't know that you're wrong. It might actually be the same legal principle.
I think it's very much the same and wouldn't be prosecuted for much the same reason.
I wholeheartedly agree it would not be prosecuted. Although I do think that there might be some technical read where it's still illegal under the law.
All right. Our next question comes from at StephenJ006, who asks, does a Clinton presidency and a new Supreme Court pretend changes on any major international legal issues?
So the short answer is a Clinton presidency, I think, does not. I think there would be a lot of continuity in major international law approaches of the U.S. government between a Clinton administration and an Obama administration. It's a very interesting question what the foreign relations law implications of a series of Democratic appointments to the court would be. And I think broadly speaking, you could probably reasonably hypothesize that there would be, first of all, more solicitude for the incorporation of, you know, foreign and international law principles in Supreme Court jurisprudence, sort of, you know, in the old Breyer v. Scalia debate about the role of foreign law, you'd have much more engagement with it and less resistance to it. And I suspect you would also have a lesser degree of deference to the executive branch in the interpretation of international law obligations. I'm not thinking right now, though, of any major areas of foreign relations law that are likely to be decided differently, you know, if you take Justice Scalia off the court and replace him with Merrick Garland. There may be some jurisdictional areas where the court would be sort of more likely to assert jurisdiction because of the absence of Justice Scalia.
All right, next we have a question from Peter Aranyi at On the PayPay. Who has a question for Susan. So he links us to a quote from an article in The Hill that says, quote, judges have been mixed over whether tricking computers into coughing up IP addresses is a violation of Fourth Amendment rights, and asks Susan what her views are on this question.
So this is an interesting question, and it's coming up more and more. I think it's really a two-part answer. The basic premise is that when individuals use anonymization tools like Tor in order to disguise their IP addresses, and then law enforcement uses network investigative techniques or other tools to learn the true IP address, does that trigger Fourth Amendment protection? So there's sort of two parts of the analysis. The first is whether or not the actual method that the law enforcement uses constitutes a search. So most courts agree that this is a search. What ends up happening is that the target or defendant is tricked into downloading something onto their computer. You have a reasonable expectation of privacy in your computer, and therefore most courts have determined that the government does need to get a warrant. That's actually a separate question than whether or not your IP address is protected. So if what the government's doing is making you download something in order to cough up your IP address, it's the action that they're taking that triggers the Fourth Amendment. But that doesn't necessarily mean you have a new or separate privacy interest in your IP address. It actually is the prevailing view in courts that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in IP addresses. That's under the third-party doctrine. you share your IP address with your internet service provider and others, and therefore you have no expectation of privacy in it. The thing that becomes complicated is whenever you've taken affirmative steps to try and hide it, whether or not you then can essentially defeat the third-party doctrine. Most courts have said you can't, right? Because you still actually do advertise your true IP address to at least the first node you interact with, and then it's passed through intermediaries. So that act of the first passage is sufficient to forfeit your privacy interest, essentially. It does raise, an interesting question that's sort of underlies a lot of criticism of the third-party doctrine, which is that how can you possibly be said to be voluntarily sharing information if you're at the same time attempting to hide it? So I think under the law as it currently applies, probably there is no additional privacy interest in a masked IP address, but this will be even more sort of evidence that the third-party doctrine is potentially becoming outdated and might be due for an overhaul.
Next, we have one from Phil Walter, at PhilWalter1058, who asks, if given the power of the pen, how would Lawfare define hostilities in the War Powers Resolution?
So this is a really interesting question. So first of all, let me say that Lawfare, which never takes a position institutionally on any issue, would not try to define hostilities in its institutional capacity. A bunch of different people on Lawfare might try to do it in their individual capacities on the platform, but the platform itself, the organization, would certainly not have a view of it. So, if the question is, how would I do it? The honest answer is, I really don't know. I think that with the following bounds on the thing, I think the administration's position with respect to there not being hostilities in Libya was ridiculous, and I also think that the briefest of actions does not constitute hostilities for, without some extended engagement. Beyond that, I really don't know. I think it's actually a very hard question, and it's a very important question in the context of scattered military operations that take place over a very wide geographic area, punctuated by large spaces of time in which nothing happens. And so if you're very periodically operating in a particular location, do you or don't you consider that hostilities, and how consistent does it have to be before you think of it? But I would not distinguish, as the administration did, between flying drones and flying human pilots. I wouldn't distinguish between circumstances in which there are, is limited capacity for casualties and circumstances that aren't. It seems to me the answer has to be, how frequently are things going boom?
So next we have a question from at Pwn All The Things, otherwise known as Matt Tate, who asks, should, and if so, how should the U.S. de-escalate the U.S.-Russia dispute over the DNC leaks in light of this week's leaks?
I think you escalate. I know that that's not a terribly political answer, but I'm not a politician. So I think ultimately de-escalation is backing down. And so the name of the game here is to find a way to send some kind of clear message. I don't think that message needs to be an escalatory message, right? Like things are going to get worse and worse and worse for you, or sort of even engaging in kind of the brinksmanship. I think it's more a question of making it clear that each and every time this happens, there will be a consequence, and deciding what that consequence is going to look like and sticking to it. I also think, though, there's sort of an important message in actively refusing to de-escalate. And that's this sort of how exactly we're going to respond to this type of information warfare, the notion of using leaks to damage political institutions or the administration's credibility. I think it's important to send a message that actually our democratic institutions are strong enough to withstand this kind of stuff. And so we're going to name it. We're going to be very open about attributing when we're able to. And also that we are not going to be bullied out of sort of protecting our core processes. And in some ways, that goal is served by, you know, allowing our press to robustly cover the materials that are within these leaks. I also sort of wonder what exactly could be worse. So at this point, it really is just speculation that these shadow brokers are somehow connected to the Russians. There isn't the kind of technical evidence that exists for the DNC hacks, where it really is very highly likely that the Russians are behind that particular activity. It's more speculative that the shadow brokers leak is a Russian escalation. So I think you always want to be careful when you're not exactly sure who leaked what and for what purposes. But even if, say, for example, the United States government has secret information that they are independently aware of shadow brokers being connected to the Russians, I don't think that they should view that as a type of Russian escalation, and then if we do something else, they're going to do something else even worse. Damaging information is damaging information. I don't know that there's much worse out there that the Russians could leak without, and particularly without giving up some really valuable sources and methods of their own. And so I really think that this is a moment in which we should probably stand our ground. Of course, the problem is that it's not entirely clear from the outside that there has been a response from the administration, nor what that response would be. So the government has methods of signaling their displeasure against cyber activity that is not visible to the public. This might be a case in which they might also want to take some clearer public actions like sanctions, something where it's more visible to sort of the rest of the world how exactly we're going to respond to this activity in the future.
I just want to add something that's, I think, implicit in what Susan just said, which is, you know, the question, emphasis on the word de-escalation implies that there's been a mutual escalation here, which I don't think is really true. This is a situation in which, if the reporting is correct, there has been a set of actions by one side targeting something very important to the United States, that is the integrity of its election process. And so I think before you talk about de-escalating it, the initial question is whether and how you respond. And, you know, if that creates an escalatory cycle that needs to then be de-escalated, then you deal with that then. But initially, the question is, you know, how are you going to hit back?
So next we have a question from Rosalind Jordan at RosJordanAJE for Ben specifically. She asks, what legal topics do you think are overlooked by the media and the general public, and why?
So a general class of activity in law that is grossly overlooked by the press is jurisdiction. And there's a reason for this, because whenever a court decides not to reach an issue for jurisdictional reasons, the inevitable way to think about it as a member of the press is with a sort of disappointment that, you know, we're not going to have a decision on X issue, or the court dodged X issue. But the result is that the idea of jurisdiction is almost systematically ignored. It's a set of technicalities that prevent you from reaching questions that the press wants to have judicial input into and answers about. And I think this is actually really regrettable because, we live in a society in which courts are exceptionally powerful. And one of the very few limitations on that power is the doctrines that limit the scope of the court's authority to begin with. And so I think there's a tendency in the press to look at as inconveniences those set of things that are about limiting courts' power, because the press tends to be so interested in the courts as limitations on other actors' power. So jurisdiction is just one. There are some others that I could name as well.
Next, we have a series of questions from at NC Weaver, who is our own Nicholas Weaver. He asks, in order, first, have you tried asking Lieutenant General Flynn if he can come up with a sane reason to vote for Trump on national security grounds? Then he asks, can whoever has to brief Trump keep his advisors, Christie and Flynn, out of the room? And finally, is there any legal reason not to ensure that General Flynn is excluded from any classified briefing by Trump?
So I will take those all sort of collectively or in turn. No, I do not, unfortunately, have the direct contact information of General Flynn, although if he wanted to get in touch, I would offer my personal opinions on it. Although, look, he's pretty publicly attempting to make the national security case for Trump. It's more of a, never Hillary character. But I think it's fair to say he's at least trying to make it, and presumably he finds it sane, one would assume. As to these questions of whether or not Flynn and Christie are entitled to be in the room with Trump during his classified briefing, look, the entire classified briefing is essentially a matter of executive discretion. So the president doesn't actually have to give this briefing at all. It's a customary tradition that dates back to Truman, actually. There actually is no legal reason to do any of it, and so there are no kind of attendant obligations. That said, there is a lot of control over who the executive branch will permit to be in the room. They could single out, for example, General Flynn. There's been some speculation about Flynn's conduct after he left the military, attending the RT anniversary dinner, making comments that some perceive as uncomfortably cozy with Putin. That said, I'm not sure that it's fair to sort of assume that he hasn't safely handled classified information or others, right? This is somebody who was privy to some of the nation's most sensitive secrets over the course of his career and hasn't actually given any demonstration that he hasn't treated that information appropriately. So I don't think that there's any sort of specific reason, at least not in the public knowledge, as to why you would want to exclude Flynn in particular. And then there's also just sort of the prudential question here of, while the president is obviously a Democrat, is obviously endorsed Hillary Clinton, it's really important that we have civil and collaborative transition of power. And so while the president engages in political activities kind of with one hand, actually the function of the transition of the executive is supposed to be as non-political and non-partisan as possible, right? The transition teams meet. It's all actually a relatively kind of productive thing. In some ways, the classified briefing is the first step towards that transition. So it's important to treat kind of both teams as even-handed as possible. Being prudent but generous and not sort of petty in excluding their advisors from classified briefings, I think is a positive thing. That said, at the end of the day, the protection of classified information trumps everything, and the CIA and the DNI affirmatively would not give any information that they thought would be compromised or would be have serious consequences were it compromised.
Just one additional note on the specific question about whether we've asked General Flynn to write about his case for Trump. So we haven't reached out to him in particular, but we have said publicly on multiple occasions that we are actually eager to run the national security case for Trump if any respected, serious national security writer wants to write it. So far, we've had no takers on that, including General Flynn, but our Lawfare's pages are certainly open to General Flynn to write about why he thinks Trump would be a good choice for national security purposes anytime. We're certainly prepared to run that piece, and I'd love to have a piece from General Flynn about that.
Next, we have a question from Chet Manley at Nighthawk Danger, who asks, what are y'all's thoughts on new talk this year of Cyber Command getting boosted to Combatant Command level? Is Cyber Command mature enough at this point? Is it good to fully separate the two?
First of all, that's an awesome Twitter handle. And I will start with the confession that for the first full year that I worked at NSA, I thought everyone was saying combat and command. And I was really, really confused until I finally saw it written down. So yeah, they've announced now, I think formally, that NSA and Cyber Command are going to split. It's not a surprise, right? This was kind of the plan really all along, that like a beautiful baby bird, Cyber Command would be co-located with NSA for some period of time and then sort of develop adequate force capacity, force strength to separate off into a combatant command. So whether it's sort of a good idea or a bad idea that they split, it was always the idea that they would split. And so I don't think that that's quite as controversial a decision. The question really is whether or not this is the right timing. So there was a lot of discussion about whether or not the right time to split the two was whenever General Alexander retired. That was sort of an obvious point. One of the reasons why there's been a sort of desire to split is because there's a perception that it would be a positive thing to have a civilian head of NSA. And of course, because a civilian cannot be the head of Cyber Command, that had always been impossible. So they decided not to do it at that point, I think, for a number of prudential reasons, but kind of at the core because Cyber Command wasn't ready, right? They weren't adequately staffed, they weren't adequately trained, they were sort of continuing to rely too heavily on borrowing personnel and sort of and sharing those kinds of appropriations resources. That said, it's, I don't know that things are sort of at an ideal point where we're, all right, we've checked every single box, they're ready to go. They're post-sequestration. The government has less resources, not more. And this is really a question of money and people. I think the important thing will be that Cyber Command, at least for the immediate future, looks like it will continue to be physically co-located at Fort Meade. And so you can have, even if sort of formally the relationship is going to change and there's going to be, they're obviously going to be moving in new directions and having a new head and a different person be the head of each place will have significant consequences on what exactly the collaboration looks like. But keeping them in the same place for now is probably a good way to take a step towards sort of independence and splitting while not losing some of those supportive benefits. I think you never quite know when it's the right time, but since it needed to happen eventually, and since I think this administration really wanted to see it happen before they left office, there's no time like the present.
So wait, just so that we get a sense of sort of what level of maturity has Cyber Command reached, is this, like bar mitzvah? Is this graduation from high school, mm-hmm. moving out mm-hmm. of the parents' house? Is it, college, that you're all grown up now? Kind of like, what is this?
Right. I'd put it like maybe at a quinceanera, right? So slightly more than a bar mitzvah. It's they have their own legal authorities. They have their own they've built out a sufficient sort of staff and infrastructure that they can now function on their own. Obviously, they use a lot of the same tools. Obviously, they use a lot of the same technical expertise. Ultimately, moving into the future, the most important thing is going to be for Cyber Command and NSA to have a sufficiently close relationship for a very high and rapid level of deconfliction. Being in the same place has the benefit of making it of facilitating some of those types of communications. In the future, what that might look like and whether or not, my guess is that it'll be sort of a two steps forward, one steps back, right? They will move out into an independent space. They will be considered a little bit too independent. There's some kind of problem will happen. They will realign a little bit, right? That this is going to be, this really is the beginning of a new phase of the process, as opposed to sort of, this is the moment of the split and now it's sort of done.
All right. And to finish up, we have a question from at DA Metzger, neither here nor there, who asks, was Stuxnet an act of war? If so, would it be legal for Iran to respond?
So that's an interesting question. So Dan Metzger is one of my longtime Twitter sparring partners. So shout out to him. Lovely to close on this question. So look, the short answer to this question is it is an invasion of, it's certainly an invasion of sovereignty or a violation of Iranian sovereignty. If somebody attacked one of our nuclear installations, using a cyber means in a fashion that disrupted the operation of a centrifuge or 1,000 centrifuges, say, we would absolutely consider that a matter that warranted a military response. So I have no trouble saying, in that sense, sure, it's an act of war. You have to figure in when you authorize a covert action like that, the likelihood and capability of a country to respond, but I would certainly be the last person to say this is the kind of thing that, if done to us, is an act of war, and if done by us, is not. It's a very serious attack on the sovereignty of another country, and that's the kind of thing you do with meticulous awareness of the possible consequences to doing it, which is, of course, one of the reasons that we've never acknowledged it.
Right. I certainly agree that if the identical activity was taken against the United States, we would almost certainly consider it an act of war, although I don't know how we would necessarily respond, but that it would sort of meet that threshold. One thing that sort of makes Stuxnet different from lots of other types of sort of cyber conflicts that have occurred is this notion of kinetic damage. My guess is that ultimately the way cyber acts of war are going to be defined as a normative matter is going to rely pretty heavily on the presence and nature of a kinetic consequence. Even though I do think we would view it as an act of war, I think there is a difference between, the centrifuges spinning very quickly and then going offline versus, exploding, for example. So I do think that we should probably be really sort of thoughtful and measured about making kinetic consequences a relevant or, sort of a threshold part of a cyber act of war potentially, and then also differentiating between different types of kinetic consequences, right? Because, we see in Saudi Aramco, even in the Sony hacks, lots and lots of things can be destroyed. It can cost lots and lots of money, and that's not quite an act of war. So maybe destroying a centrifuge is, the nature of that is somehow different. I think we have to proceed very cautiously here because, of course, wherever we draw the line is where everybody else gets to draw the line, too.
Right. So, there's a lot of variables here. So the term act of war is actually a little bit imprecise, right? The concept that we're trying to get to is, A, is it a violation of sovereignty, and B, is it a use of force? Within the meaning of the law of armed conflict, and what type of response or retaliation or reciprocal use of force does it provoke? There are a few variables that nobody knows the precise contours of the question of what sort of constitutes a use of force in cyberspace. But let's say that there are a few variables that here, some of which point to, yes, it's absolutely a use of force, and some of which don't. So one of them is, were people killed? The answer is no. And so, you know, you say most, when you think about an act of war, you generally think about damage to people. Second is, was stuff destroyed? And the answer is yeah. You could have destroyed some of those centrifuges by other means. Most of them involve things exploding or, you know, things that we would typically think of in the language of use of force. And then the following, which to me, the final one, which to me is the, you know, decisive one, is it an attack on critical infrastructure? And, you know, we would look at our nuclear facilities and, as matters of extreme sensitivity and extreme, criticality to the military and energy infrastructure of the country. And so I think if you're you should not, as the United States intelligence community, be going after in a destructive way somebody else's critical infrastructure without an awareness that a reasonable person on the other side of, you know, would see that as a use of force.
But notably, to sort of put it in its proper context, and of course the United States has never formally acknowledged participation in Stuxnet, but I think there's a number of books that have come out about Stuxnet that that note that actually one of the reasons why Stuxnet was allegedly undertaken was to dissuade the Israelis from potentially taking more traditional military action. So at the time, it appears that the plan was to draw a nation back from a more sort of clear act of war. So it's a complex question.
Right. I mean, it's very possible that the answer is it's a use of force, but it's a lesser use of force than the other alternative that was on the table at the time. Okay, so thank you to everybody who submitted. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Quinta Jurassic, who assembled all your questions. Our music, as ever, is performed by the Right Honorable Sophia Yan. If you're one of those slacker, schlub, terrible people who has not yet rated the Lawfare podcast and reviewed the Lawfare podcast, you need to get out of the category of slacker, schlub, terrible person and into the category of those who have come into the light. So help us share it, tweet it, send the Lawfare podcast in a box with a ribbon to all your friends. Please do take a moment and write us a little review on Stitcher or iTunes or whatever podcast distribution you use. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.